Hey, everybody, from the velvet-lined news trenches of Brussels, Belgium. It's Clark, and it's time for Tech Podcast number 319. The World, as you probably know, is a co-production of the BBC World Service, Public Radio International, and WGBH Radio in Boston. You can find out more about the show, including how to subscribe to all of our other great podcasts at theworld.org. Okay, sorry we missed you last week. I was traveling, and things have been a bit hectic and crazy between the traveling and what's going on in the Middle East and North Africa. Of course, I continue to look for great tech angles for you. A lot of what I've been seeing of late is stuff that we've been covering here on the podcast for 4 or 5 years. As soon as we find some really great new killer tech angle on this stuff, we'll bring it to you. So what's in the podcast? Let's start with Hillary Clinton's internet freedom speech last week, which did, of course, touch on events in the Middle East and North Africa, of course, and the use of social networking tools and the ideas of internet censorship and content filtering and all that stuff that we've been talking about in this podcast for ages. So here's how the big show tackled Hillary Clinton's internet freedom speech. Here we go.
Secretary of State Hillary Clinton said today that the United States is giving $25 million this year to help dissidents get around internet repression by autocratic regimes. But she said that government's misuse of the internet is only a symptom.
Iran isn't awful because the authorities used Facebook to shadow and capture members of the opposition. Iran is awful because it is a government that routinely violates the rights of its people.
That's Secretary Clinton earlier today. Thousands turned out in Tehran yesterday to protest their government. Nikahan Kosar is an Iranian cartoonist in Washington. He moderates an online news site for Iranians who are in and outside of Iran. He has praise for another State Department initiative, a new Twitter feed in Farsi.
That possibly wouldn't help exactly those people on the streets, but it's very encouraging, and it shows the online activists inside and outside Iran that somebody is actually caring for what they're doing, and it's very symbolic. Many people in Iran are connected through Facebook, and they would like to actually post news materials, videos, and everything that they get on Facebook to share. So there could be a lot of internet sources or internet material that it could really help people inside Iran. Like, for instance, yesterday I got 3 videos from one of the demonstrators and posted it possibly just half an hour after he had just shot those videos. And by that, so many people could see what was happening on the streets of Tehran, but through the website that I was working on it in the States. And those people were in Iran. So it's a very weird connection, and it's working, actually. But we have to find better ways to empower the people who are under a lot of pressure inside Iran because of firewalls and also being tracked by the Revolutionary Guards and the Ministry of Intelligence.
And in terms of the Iranian government itself, does it use social networking tools, Facebook, Twitter, to its own end?
We've had reports that many members of the Basij, or the volunteer militia, and also the Revolutionary Guards are using fake names and appearing on Facebook, becoming members of different fan pages or becoming friends with activists. And they try to actually give false information and even sometimes discourage people from going and acting on the streets or performing what they want to do, or even they try to crack down smaller networks by entering these, I call them viruses, human viruses.
Did any of that happen yesterday, preceding or during the protests yesterday?
I'm not sure about that still, but when I was posting a few notes on Facebook, I got a few comments from members, and they didn't sound right. I felt that one of those people was trying to say that nothing has happened on the streets and people are just listening to the wrong wave. I just cut the guy off because I was actually witnessing what was happening through reliable sources. So I found out that these guys are really active in trying to discourage people.
Can you tell who's one step ahead, the government or the dissidents, the protesters?
There are times that, let's say, the activists are saying that we're going to have this action next week on that very specific time. So then the government would be ahead. But on the other hand, when people are using fake identities, pseudonyms, and the government cannot detect who's who, it's working in a way. There are problems for many activists in Iran, and they believe that probably the American government or other governments can help them pass through these firewalls and be protected from these human viruses or these hackers working for the government.
All right. Thank you very much, Nikhan Kosar.
Thanks. Thanks.
So as anyone who's listened to the Tech Podcast for a while can tell you, if you're looking for the latest into gadgets and gizmos, then you're probably listening to the wrong podcast. In fact, there are probably a million other podcasts that you can listen to where you can get that kind of stuff. That's just not what we do here. We tend to focus more on how tech is used in everyday life, how people are shaping tech, how people are being shaped by technology, real world uses for these sorts of things. So this is a prime example. We did a really great sequence on the show last week about how activists in Britain are incorporating social networking technologies into their work. Now, they contacted me about doing this piece, and I said, you know what, the gee whiz wow factor of people using social networking tools is over. I keep seeing articles about this, but literally that was news like 2 years ago, 3 years ago maybe. It's not anymore. But that doesn't mean that these stories aren't good. What's interesting is finding out how and why people are using this technology. So here we go. This is a sequence that talks about UK Uncut and then its US counterpart. Here we go.
The internet and social media are also the tools that young protesters in Britain are deploying in their fight against the old order. These activists are not seeking the overthrow of an autocrat. They're looking to undo some of the deep spending cuts the British government announced last fall. They have formed a pressure group, and they call it UK Uncut. That's UK for United Kingdom, and uncut as in uncut those tax cuts. UK Uncut says that that could be done if companies such as Vodafone and Barclays are made to pay more taxes. The World's Laura Lynch tells us about the movement and its targets in this report from London.
As Britain limps through another month of bad economic news, the cost of food and fuel are rising, public sector jobs are disappearing, and mortgages are hard to come by, there are some bright spots. The banks at the heart of the financial crisis of 2008 seem to be feeling much better now. British stalwart Barclays topped the business news today.
All eyes are on Barclays this morning. They're announcing their annual profits. There's bonus news too. Simon's got the details. So profits up and by quite some margin.
A whopping increase in profits, up 32% to £6.1 billion. And the main reason
here's a recipe for public discontent. Combine big bank profits with multi-million dollar bank bonuses for executives. Then throw in corporations who avoid paying millions more in taxes. Finally, add harsh government spending cuts, like the ones announced here last October. The night the cuts were spelled out, Johnny Marbles went out with his buddies.
As a group of friends came to this pub, it was just a group of people having a few drinks, having the kind of conversation I think probably lots of people across the country were having.
That night they hatched a plan. They decided to examine which corporations and individuals were avoiding big tax bills, then target them with peaceful protests. In the days that followed, they used Twitter and Facebook, encouraging others to do the same thing. Within weeks, the protests spread across the country as protesters suddenly gathered inside stores, catching staff and security off guard. So far, the protesters haven't forced anyone to pay more tax, nor have they persuaded the government to reverse cuts to public spending. But they have drawn attention to the issue, and they've certainly caught the attention of the business community. Richard Lambert is the outgoing director of the Confederation of British Industry.
It is a matter of concern, especially at a time when the whole emphasis on job creation in this country over the next year or two is going to have to come from business investment. So we need an atmosphere and environment in which businesses are encouraged to invest and create new jobs.
As new chapters spring up, so do new targets. Outside a London branch of Barclays Bank, UK Uncut founder Daniel Garvin sketches out the plan for this weekend. Protest with a twist, occupying bank branches across the country, then highlighting the public services that are at risk of shutting down.
So we'll be paying Barclays a visit this Saturday, setting up libraries and other facilities that have been closed, that will be closed as a result of the cuts, to really sort of draw attention and link the banking crisis to the cuts.
Barclays didn't receive a taxpayer-funded bailout, but Garvin argues it's benefited from other measures, such as short-term loans and loan guarantees. And while he's wary of drawing comparisons, He admires the social media-fueled protests in Egypt and Tunisia.
It's amazing to see the value and the people power and the power of political activism and what it can achieve. And certainly we try to take great courage and great inspiration from what's happening in North Africa.
There's no suggestion of revolution in Britain, but people are only just starting to feel the painful effects of spending cuts as libraries close and bus routes shut down. In fact, protest may turn out to be one of the country's few growth industries in the months ahead. For The World, I'm Laura Lynch in London.
My name is Carl Gibson. I'm the founder of U.S. Uncut.
That's right, U.S. Uncut. The British movement Laura Lynch just told us about has already spawned an offshoot here in the States. U.S. Uncut is based in Jackson, Mississippi.
U.S. Uncut is a very simple premise. It's stating before you fire one more teacher, before you cut one more benefit, before you freeze one more salary, I think our leaders have an obligation to the rest of us to make sure that the richest of the rich pay their fair share in taxes like everyone else.
So what prompted you just about a week ago?
Well, I had heard about folks in the UK organizing in very small groups and deciding that they should do something about the austerity cuts that are cutting jobs and salaries. And I was inspired by the people who said, you know, before you take away my housing subsidy or raise my college tuition, how about you make Vodafone pay income taxes? The story especially about them blockading Vodafone and refusing Vodafone to earn income until they paid income taxes, that really rang true for me. And I think 2/3 of American corporations don't pay taxes, so I wanted to do something like that in the United States.
So what's your organization look like right now?
Right now, I'm helping coordinate protests in 12 states from the West Coast to the East Coast. Each state chairman coordinates with me, and we're all coordinating a day of protest on February 26th with UK Uncut, and we're all going to protest the big banks together on that day.
Where do you intend the protest to be?
Right now, it's going to be at probably a Bank of America branch here in Mississippi. I'm getting other folks to organize, find targets like Bank of America, Citibank, Wells Fargo, banks that have paid little to no income taxes in the last 2 years despite making billions in revenue. Those are our main targets right now.
Two points on that. One is that in some cases tax avoidance can be legal. Are you making the distinction between those who are finding tax loopholes and doing things that are actually legal and those who aren't?
Oh, well, see, yeah, that's the whole source of the problem, is that these corporations are legally allowed to stash away income in offshore tax havens. And because of that, the United States loses about $100 billion in tax revenue every year, according to the GAO. And while that's legal, I would hope to see legislation introduced in Congress that makes offshore tax havens illegal and makes these corporations pay income taxes to the United States if they earn income here.
The GAO being the Government Accountability Office. I wonder if you could respond to the business leader who we heard in Laura's piece, who said this is really a matter of concern right now because the whole emphasis is on job creation in this country, meaning in England, over the next year or two, and it's going to have to come from business investment. Are you concerned that the same thing could be said of the United States in terms of job creation?
I absolutely sympathize with the business owner. I understand that a business has an obligation to their shareholders to lower their costs and make sure that their share is as valuable as possible. But I think at the same time, corporations have an obligation to pay income taxes accordingly. A lot of these businesses don't do that.
All right. Thank you. Carl Gibson in Jackson, Mississippi. Thanks again.
Thank you.
U.S. Uncut is just getting off the ground now, but you can find a short documentary on U.K. Uncut on our website, which is theworld.org.
We're going to do a few completely different things here to end the podcast because, quite frankly, I can't take any more pieces about social networking. I know it's important, but really, okay, enough. I can't take it. I think Jeremy Pope on the Facebook page said, are you going to do a segment about the Egyptian guy who named his kid Facebook? Oh, boy. No, I'm not going to do a whole segment on it, but there you go. An Egyptian guy named his daughter Facebook. I was thinking it as maybe more of a son's name. I don't know. But anyway, Facebook. Too bad they didn't have twins. It could be Facebook and Twitter. Or triplets, Facebook, Twitter, and, well, take your pick. We're going to really switch gears here. So many of you wrote in to talk about how much you loved the Jerry Wells piece about his love of radio. And it really was a shockingly good piece of audio. Journalism, I have to say. Nick Rankin's piece was just amazing, and I'm glad that you all enjoyed every second of that Jerry Wells thing. The BBC runs so many fantastic things, and here's another sort of look back into technology history. This is a look at the craze surrounding cryonic freezing back in the 1960s. Here we go.
Today we're taking you back over 40 years to the early days of cryonics, the science of immortality. Trish Flanagan reports.
It's the 12th of January, 1967, and in Glendale, California, a team of four men are gathered around the body of psychology professor James Bedford, who has just died from testicular cancer at the age of 73.
He was still just a little bit dead, probably no more than 3 or 4 minutes into the first phase of death, which is clinical death.
Bob Nelson was one of the group who were about to try to cryonically freeze a human being for the first time. He still remembers a photograph taken of the body that day.
In the actual temporary storage box, covered with dry ice, and you could see the dry ice fumes evaporating. And Dr. Bruno was down on one knee adjusting the dry ice. We were both in medical garb. It was a stage photograph, but it was very, very much indicative of what took place that day.
The idea of freezing bodies for the future was new and completely unproven, but it had recently become popular.
In 1966, I read a book, The Prospect of Immortality, written by Professor Robert Ettinger. He's a physics professor. And the book just astounded me, as it has many people. The thesis is that it is possible to suspend life by using low temperature. The assumption is that technology will get better and better, and that if we place an animal or a human being into a state of suspended animation, the day will come when we can revive him.
But Bob ran an electronics company. He wasn't a scientist and didn't know anyone else who believed it might be possible, until one day as he was driving home, listening to the radio.
If I rule the world, every man would be as free as a bird.
Tony Bennett was always a favorite artist of mine. I was in a traffic jam in the San Fernando Valley. He was singing If I Ruled the World.
Take my word, we would treasure each day that occurred.
The disc jockey interrupted and said, hey, you listeners, any of you out there don't like the idea of dying and want to live forever? Be at Helen Klein's home this Saturday night, and he gave the address. He said, there's going to be a group of chronics people, and they're going to tell you how you can get yourself frozen and live forever. And so I went to that meeting. We set up a nonprofit organization, the Chronics Society of California. I was elected president, and my goal was to actually approach the medical community and get the research done that would perfect these methods.
But things moved faster than the Californian Cryonics Society could have anticipated, and the team found themselves embarking on the project in a hurry.
We got a call one day that there was a gentleman whose father was terminal and wanted to be frozen. And my personal preference would have been not to do the freezing at that time, because if we did, we were destined to lose our scientific advisory council. After talking to Robert Ettinger, the author of The Prospect of Immortality, he convinced me that nothing could be more helpful to get the cryonics program off the ground. And this was exceptionally good opportunity, because this man was a psychology professor at the Glendale College. So the day came in January when we decided to go ahead and prepare for Dr. Bedford's freezing. I had Dr. Dante Bruno, he was a cryobiologist for the society, and Robert Perhoder, who is an author of many, many books on human hibernation and suspended animation, and Dr. Renault Abel as the attending physician. We needed about 2 weeks, we figured, to get everything, the chemicals and material and coordination ready. And we didn't have that. We got a call in about a week. Dr. Bedford was very close to death. So we had to, on the spur of the moment, get together and get our equipment together and go to Glendale and do the very best job we could.
No one, not even the dying man himself, was particularly confident about the experiment.
I had one talk with Dr. Bedford several days prior to his suspension, where he told me, he said, Mr. Nelson, I have little hope that I will myself ever be resuscitated, but I have such enormous faith in the eventual perfection of chronic suspension that I choose to be the first in the hopes that it'll help my children or my grandchildren and those who would embrace extended life. And so that is what led up to the day on January 12th, the moment Dr. Bedford passed into clinical death. We were there. We packed him in ice. Dr. Bruno and Robert Perhoder began the process of perfusion, which is removing the part of the blood and replace it with a biological antifreeze called dimethyl sulfoxide. This was a solution that was mixed with a water solution injected into the body as the temperature of Dr. Bedford was reduced. Dimethyl sulfoxide has an odor similar to garlic.
But the Californian Cryonic Society hadn't yet built a storage facility for frozen bodies.
We had no place to take them. I was able to talk Robert Perhoder, the author, into bringing Dr. Bedford to his garage and keeping him there for a day or two until I could find some place to keep him, because his son, Norman Bedford, who was really the recipient of the funds that Dr. Bedford had left. He left $300,000, but his son had made arrangements in Arizona to bring Dr. Bedford there, but not for 10 days. We brought him to Robert Perhoda's home. Mr. Perhoder called me the next morning and said his wife was threatening to call the police if we didn't get Dr. Bedford out of his garage. Fortunately, I had some friends in Topanga Canyon that I called and pleaded with. The only trouble is to get Dr. Bedford to their home. The hills and turns and twists of Topanga Canyon are treacherous. And I had to put this container in the back of my pickup truck, with fumes pouring out of it as I drove along, so it was hectic. However, we did it. We got him there and able to keep him in Topanga Canyon for 10 days, and after which time we delivered him to Balboa Park in the San Fernando Valley to a mortician that drove him to Phoenix, Arizona, where he was placed in a capsule.
And that is where he has remained until this day. Bob Nelson and the Cryonic Society of California froze several more people, but there were mishaps and lawsuits, and Bob eventually left the movement. But 37 years later, he went to Arizona to visit the body of Dr. Bedford.
It was a wonderful feeling. It gave me goosebumps to think that this great man had been the first man frozen, and that by some miracle, in spite of the family intervention and the difficulty during the early cryonics years, he was still in suspension.
And what did Dr. Bedford's body look like?
You can't see him physically. What I did is I saw his capsule, like a huge stainless steel thermos capsule. There is a lid on the top of these capsules, and they don't take them off because the vigorous motion of taking the cap off and putting it on is what damaged one capsule that contained the body of a lady that was frozen in New York, and that capsule failed, and so the suspension failed. I did not actually see Dr. Bedford directly. You know, I'm sure he was perfectly preserved.
Cryonics is still on the fringes of scientific endeavor, and it's likely to stay there, unless one day someone opens a capsule and successfully brings the body inside back to life.
Now, of course, last week, we missed out on Valentine's Day. I'm really sorry about that. My least favorite holiday of all, by the way. Not that I don't love all of you listeners immensely. But the BBC did an interesting little interview on Valentine's Day, and it's got a great little tech angle to it. Now, wherever Troy Golden goes, his backpack goes along with him. He never lets it out of his sight day or night. Now, there's a good reason for this. Golden, who is a pastor from Geary, Oklahoma, suffers from a genetic condition which weakened his heart. He had a pioneering operation last September where his heart was replaced with a plastic heart. To keep his blood circulating, he needs a pneumatic pump. And that's what he carries around in his backpack with him. Here's Troy Golden explaining a bit more to the BBC.
The total artificial heart is basically just two pumps. One pump that pumps your deoxygenated blood to your lungs, and another one that pumps your oxygenated blood then back around to the rest of your body. That's basically all it really is in simplest of terms, is just two basic pumps.
So you have something sort of completely artificial inside you, And you have a pump on the outside.
Yeah, and then I have a Freedom Driver that allows me to be home. That's basically just a small compressor that's pushing air that pushes the valves inside the pumps to pump the blood around.
Now, I've got headphones on at the moment, so I can hear quite clearly not only your voice, but what's happening in the background. I can hear a pump. Is that it?
That's it, yes.
That's what you live with every day?
Right. That's what I live with every day.
It's a constant reminder, but it's a pretty nice reminder. It's given you your life back, really.
Yes, it is. It is a very good reminder that I am alive, and it has given a lot of my life back to me. I wasn't able to do anything before I had the surgery in September of 2009. It took two people to get me out of bed, and now I'm able to get around on my own, and I've been able to go back to preaching some. My wife still pastors a church, but I do preach, which is very wonderful.
And that pump I can hear there, I mean, how big is it?
It is about 13.5 pounds by itself, and with the batteries and backpack and everything, it's around 17 pounds.
And everywhere you go, the backpack goes, clearly.
Correct, yes.
As you say, it's sort of pretty much life-changing. How permanent is it?
It is what I will have until heart becomes available, regular heart, you know, for a heart transplant. So it can sustain me basically as long as need be.
It's there sort of every moment of every day of your life. Do you see it as something temporary or something which has now become part of you?
I guess right now it's probably becoming something that's more become a part of me right now. I've had it for several months, so, you know, it's something that I'm beginning to get used to, although I will appreciate, you know, when I'm able not to have to have a backpack and have, you know, tubes run inside of me, but it is definitely a lifesaver.
Does it run on, what, batteries? Do you need to change them?
Yes, it has two batteries that run it, and then also, you know, it can be plugged in to electricity. The batteries give me about 2.5 hours to 2.5 to 3 hours, and I have a couple sets of them, so I have a little bit of freedom. You know, I can be away from being plugged in for a while.
And have you, by now, just completely got used to that constant pumping sound in the background?
Yes, I have gotten used to it, except for, you know, like you were able to tell, it's like talking on the telephone without trying to get it kind of covered up is kind of hard because it is pretty loud.
But it's a loudness you must appreciate every day.
Oh, yes, it is. It is great to know that my heart is pumping. I guess it's not mine, but it is wonderful to feel alive again.
Troy Golden there from Geary, Oklahoma, telling the BBC about his amazing new heart. I thought that was a great way to close out Tech Podcast number 319. But first, an update. You remember it was about a year ago that we did a big report on Pechakucha, which is Japanese for chit-chat. And it was about this series of rolling global series of presentations by architects, designers, a whole bunch of other creative folk. It was going on around the world. I think it started in Australia and New Zealand, and then they had successive presentations in cities around the world, and the whole idea was to raise money for Haiti. So they raised about $80,000. And they were doing this in conjunction with Architecture for Humanity, which builds and rebuilds in places like Haiti. So wanted to give you an update on how Global Pechakucha Day for Haiti went. Like I said, they raised $80,000. They raised enough money to rebuild one of the devastated schools in Haiti. And I'm going to read from the Pechakucha website now. 1 year on, we are very proud to say that the dream is becoming a reality. And Architecture for Humanity have begun to rebuild schools in Haiti, one of which is directly funded by Global Pechakucha Day. So to mark the occasion, the head of Architecture for Humanity, Cameron Sinclair, who we interviewed for that piece that we did a year ago, did one of the classic Pechakucha presentations, which they've put up online, where you can see the design for the school that the Global Pachacuti Day funded. I will put a link to that presentation up at the show notes. That's theworld.org/technology, so you can come along and take a look at that. Okay. Don't forget, as much as I am tired of talking about social networking, you can follow us on Facebook. We're World's Tech Pod. We're on Twitter, where we're also World's Tech Pod, just to make it easy for you. If you want to email me, the email is Clark, C-L-A-R-K, .Boyd, B-O-Y-D, at bbc.co.uk. Okay, we'll be back in your earbuds next week.
Support for the World's Technology Podcast comes from the National Science Foundation, where discoveries begin, nsf.gov, and from the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs and their innovations to solve the world's most pressing problems at skoll.org.